I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Joanna Fowler. She is radiochemistry group leader at Brookhaven National Laboratory. She's winner of National Medal of Science and National Academy of Sciences Awards. And tonight at 6 o'clock, she will be leading a student discussion called Imagining the Brain's Pathways to Addiction, sponsored by the Santa Fe Alliance for Science as part of their Science Cafe for Young Thinkers series. And it's at the O'Keefe Education Annex. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So you will be talking about addiction on a very specific level, meaning what's actually going on in our brains and our bodies. When a person gets addicted to something, whether it's alcohol, texting, or red chili, what happens in the body that is different from non-addictive enjoyment of a substance or activity?
Your brain has a reward system, and your reward system is what keeps you eating and it keeps you reproducing. And so what happens in, say, drug abuse is all of the drugs that are abused by humans elevate a substance, a natural substance in the brain called dopamine. And dopamine is kind of at the heart of your reward system. And everything that is pleasurable will elevate dopamine to a certain extent. So your dopamine system is what keeps you eating, it keeps you reproducing, it's what makes you look forward to things. So drugs of abuse usually elevate dopamine in a very profound, powerful way. They release a lot of dopamine relative to natural reinforcers. So as time goes on, and in the person who's vulnerable for addictive behavior, the dopamine system gets what we call down-regulated. It doesn't work as well. You don't release as much dopamine, so your reward system becomes understimulated. And then there's another part of the brain called the frontal cortex, which actually puts the brakes on behavior. So then you lose the same amount of control that you had when you weren't addicted. So that's kind of a mouthful. But you basically, in addiction, we define that as a loss of control over a behavior, even if it's causing the person a problem. So it can be, a good example is a smoker who can't stop smoking even after they've had surgery for lung cancer. So, or a person who can't stop taking cocaine or drinking alcohol even though they've lost their job. So it's basically this loss of control.
Now, when we talk about dopamine, and dopamine has gotten a lot of press and people sort of talk about it as if they know what they're talking about, which most of us do not, what is the normal and healthy function of it? Apparently it has quite a lot of functions in the body.
Yes, it does. It's part of your reward system, but it's also involved in movement and in motivation. So when you have a group of cells in your brain that produce dopamine, when certain groups of these cells die, you get Parkinson's disease. So it's very much involved in movement. It's also involved in risk-taking behavior. It's, of course, involved in addiction. And so it's very much involved in just motivating people to do what needs to be done. It could be motivating you to procure food when you're hungry or to engage in mating behavior in animals and in humans. So it's pretty important, I guess I would say. It's very important. And then drugs of abuse, like cocaine, like alcohol, like nicotine, elevate dopamine. So they raise the quantity of dopamine that's produced, that is emitted from these cells, and then they stimulate the reward system, and they usually stimulate it in a very intense way so that the amount of dopamine that's released from a drug like cocaine is far, far greater than the amount of dopamine that's released in anticipation of food, for example. So if you equate dopamine and the amount of dopamine that's released in the brain with pleasure or a sense of well-being, the drug can actually outperform the natural reinforcer like food, because it does it in such an intense way. And we can image that. So that's what I'm going to be talking about. I'm talking about actually imaging these changes in the human brain.
What are some of the imaging techniques that help you to understand these processes?
Okay, well, one of the techniques that we really use a lot, because you could use it directly in humans and you can study the addicted brain of the human directly, is PET imaging. PET stands for positron emission tomography. So it's a medical imaging method that allows you to follow the movement of drugs. So you can put a radioactive label on a drug, and the radioactivity is very short half-life, so it goes away very, very rapidly, but it allows you to track the movement of the drug in the brain. So you can tell where the drug goes and how long it stays. And from that, you can get a lot of information on just how the drug is working. And then you can also label molecules that allow you to assess metabolic pathways. For example, we can measure sugar metabolism in the brain, which is a key function. It's a key energy source in the brain. And we can actually have tracers that image how much dopamine a drug releases in the brain. So we have a whole suite of tracers that allow us to measure the different processes that are involved in addiction. So PET is one. MRI imaging, which I think a lot of people have heard of, allows us to measure functional changes in the brain. So, for example, you can do a lot of studies where you stimulate the brain and you can look at which parts of the brain are lit up, which parts of the brain recruit more blood flow when you do a certain task. So all of these imaging methods are complementary. They're different. Each has strengths and each has weaknesses. But we use, in our work, we use both PET and MRI.
We're talking to Joanna Fowler about addiction and the way it's imaged. Now, what about addiction to activities, like addiction to video games or texting or things like that? You don't have a drug being introduced into your bloodstream. It's an activity. So what is happening chemically?
That's the same thing. This is a non-pharmacological addiction. It can be like gambling. And so the brain still, you don't have to have a drug present to release dopamine. When a person craves, when an addicted person craves, their brain releases dopamine. Just the thought of the drug or being in an environment where you previously took the drug, or the thought of food, the anticipation of food, you can measure changes in dopamine. So when a person is, say, addicted, can't stop playing video games, for example, yes, one would find dopamine released in those situations. Not as much as you would see in a person actually taking a dose of cocaine, but you can see changes. You can see changes when a person sees or smells a food. And so you can see how the environment can very much play into this addictive behavior, because all you need to do is see or have some kind of what we call a cue that reminds you of the drug, and your brain releases dopamine, and that elicits your motivation to go and procure the drug or the food or whatever else.
So what does it feel like when you've got a spike of dopamine in your system?
Well, I've actually never had a real spike of dopamine from a drug of abuse, but you can anticipate when you're really looking forward to an activity, when you're looking forward to a meal. It's just, you just feel good. You just feel a lot of pleasure, a lot of joy.
It's interesting, because I wonder if, I was sort of, as I was preparing to talk to you, I was thinking, I wonder what the difference is in the sensation of having this kind of spike of dopamine in your system and the sensation of actually drinking the martini.
You probably, yes, it certainly, alcohol does cause an increase in dopamine. It definitely does. And that's something that, that most people have experienced. Certainly does also a cigarette. Smoking a cigarette increases dopamine. But I think, whereas if you take something, you can measure changes in dopamine directly by putting a probe in, say, an animal's brain into the reward system. And when you show the animal food, especially if it's something highly palatable food, you would see like a little 50% increase in dopamine, a little blip. If you allow the animal to lever press, if you addict the animal and allow them to lever press for amphetamine, for example, that spike of dopamine will go up 1,100%. So you can just see a really intense, very intense high relative to the experience with the food.
So it's interesting because when you look at this, you think there's probably a continuum between non-addictive anticipation and real addiction, because we all have that delighted anticipation when we've got a piece of carrot cake coming down in a couple of minutes that we're about to eat, or whatever the thing is that we really like.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's really, really good. It's a good thing about being human is that we can appreciate these things and we can take joy in these things. The issue is, and one of the curious thing is why can, for example, some people experiment with a drug and just become an experimenter with the drug, and other people become addicted? You know, what's the difference? What happens? Why
right.
are some people vulnerable? And we figure there's about 10% of the people who will try a drug will also go on to become addicted. And you can kind of figure that out from just alcohol consumption, a huge amount of alcohol consumption in the brain, but a whole lot of social drinkers, but maybe 10% of them become alcoholics. So we figure there's a combination of things that contribute to becoming addicted. One is genetic. About 50% of the risk we figure is genetic. Some of it is developmental because the risk is much higher in adolescence. And some is environmental because just the access or the availability of a drug is another factor.
Well, also, I would imagine that there's also the factor of what a person's life is like. If a person is happy and engaged and doing well and kind of socially, you know, working with other people and things like that, versus if they're lonely and stressed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're absolutely right with that. Stressors are a major, major player in becoming addicted. And in fact, you can train an animal to self-administer drugs, but you can train them much more easily in a stressful environment. And so there have been studies done with animals in stressed versus unstressed environments, where you can actually measure the dopamine system before and after, say, at baseline and then in a stressed environment. And even changing the environment changes the dopamine system. It's pretty remarkable. So that what that brings up is how important it is in treating addiction is in changing the environment, in the things you bring up, say replacing drug taking with say hope and with an interesting life, you know, with goals.
I read a piece recently in which they had laboratory rats, and they were much more likely to get addicted if they were isolated in their own cages than if they lived together in a social group which more nearly resembled their natural habitat.
Yes, that's very true. Social isolation is very stressful.
So the difference between addiction and habit, like, I don't think you could say that I'm addicted to brushing my teeth, but I do it every single day, and I'm unhappy if I don't brush my teeth. I don't feel right, whatever, but I'm not addicted. That's, the difference is what, dopamine?
It's probably dopamine and other neurotransmitters, but the thing is you could stop, right? You could stop brushing your teeth. It would be uncomfortable. I think in addiction, you really, it's really hard to stop. It's really very hard to stop. But there's certain elements of habit, like what happens when a person is addicted, is the frontal parts of the brain. That's the part of the brain that kind of lies over your eyes. It's called orbital frontal cortex and anterior cingulate gyrus. These are the executive control parts of the brain. And in addiction, the metabolic activity of those parts of the brain go down. And so when those parts of the brain, when you lose that control that your frontal cortex normally gives you, you can go into compulsive behaviors, and you lose inhibitory control, you lose judgment. So in addiction, the really important circuit is that the dopamine system is understimulated. So your reward system is understimulated, so you're probably going to be taking the drug to compensate for that. And then the frontal cortex, which normally controls behavior, and in fact, it's a part of the brain that matures very slowly. So the frontal cortex is also very, very metabolically inactive. So you don't have that same executive control. So you crave the drug, you go and get the drug, but even if you don't want the drug, you still don't have that control in the frontal cortex that says, stop, this is not good.
You mentioned a moment ago that some drugs, well, a lot of drugs, like alcohol, let's say, 100% of people will try alcohol, 10% of them will get addicted. Well, not 100%, but most people will try it at one point or another, and 10% will get addicted. Are there some drugs that are more addictive than others? In other words, you try them once or twice and you're more likely to be an addict?
Certain routes of administration are really crucial. So, for example, cocaine. Snorted cocaine is not nearly as addictive as crack cocaine. And that's because, and we've learned this with PET, is that crack cocaine is smoked. Okay, so smoked and intravenous injection are the most rapid ways to get a drug to the brain. And the faster that drug gets to the brain, the more addictive it is. And so when you smoke a substance, like you smoke nicotine, you smoke crack cocaine, that drug gets to the brain really rapidly. And that's what the addict wants. They want something, they want to do something, they want to feel it right away. So yes, route of administration is very, very important. So the way that people take cocaine, when crack became available, the cocaine addiction really went up.
Right. And yet, crack addiction seems to be much more intense than, for example, marijuana addiction. There's controversy about whether marijuana is even addictive.
Yeah, well, it affects the same systems. It affects the brain dopamine system, and people who treat addiction will definitely say it's addictive. People lose control; they can't stop. It's particularly bad in adolescents, because adolescents have not got that same control, frontal cortex control, where they are able to anticipate the consequences of behavior and able to make judgments.
Now, talking about all the things that we're talking about and knowing the things that you do and getting to know the images and the chemical pathways and the circuits of addiction better, how does that help addicts to deal with their addiction, if it does?
I think understanding things is understanding mechanisms. I mean, how drugs work is very important. I mean, as a result of imaging studies, we now know the circuits. We didn't know before that there was an understimulated reward system, that the brain dopamine system is dampened down in the addicted person. We didn't know this business about the orbital frontal cortex and how that's correlated with the degree of the dopamine system being lower in the addict. It's the same degree of lowering of the frontal cortex. So not only do you have the understimulated reward system, you don't have the same control over the motivation to take the drug. We also know that memory circuits are involved, so that the memory of a drug, the memory of how pleasurable it was, can elicit craving. So we know a huge amount about these circuits. And because of that, there are certain drugs that can work on these circuits, that say can help tune them up. For example, there are certain drugs that work on the glutamate system that might be, and I'm not saying these are used yet, but you can envision you have a drug that's known to strengthen the frontal cortex. You can apply that. You just use the knowledge that the memory circuits are very powerful in craving, and try to remove the individual from the context of where they use the drug, or give them tools. Give them behavioral tools that say you encounter a drug, you want to take it, how to deal with that when you encounter it. And people have used imaging to help people to learn how to engage those circuits that turn this behavior or this motivation to procure the drug off, rather than pursuing this. And so as a result of that, now there are also a lot of drugs for treating addiction. There are drugs, a few drugs now that are non-nicotine drugs for smoking addiction that work well in some people. Smoking addiction is still a really hard one to deal with. So yes, by understanding these, that gives you clues on what kind of drugs to develop. And in fact, the dopamine system is complex. There are many subtypes of dopamine receptors, and there's evidence that certain subtypes of these are very, very big players in the addictive process. So there's a search for the development of medications to inhibit certain subtypes of dopamine receptors. So a whole lot is going on. One of the big problems is that pharmaceutical companies shy away from developing drugs to treat addiction.
Why is that?
It's probably not wanting to be associated with addiction. It's not like you're... There's a lot of public prejudice against the addicted person as being morally weak or lacking willpower, and generally there's just a lot of prejudice. There's a stigma. It's very much of a stigmatized disease. People hide it. They don't want to talk about it, and companies don't want to invest in treatment. And so that's really a real problem, because addiction isn't just the behavior that you think about when you think of an addicted person, a person who's drunk, or a person who's illegally dealing drugs. Addiction's also heart disease. It's cancer, because smoking is the biggest factor in deaths from heart disease and cancer. Addiction is also HIV and AIDS, because a large fraction of the HIV infections come from intravenous drug use. Addiction is also accidents and violence from alcohol. So it has many, many faces and is a huge public health problem. Yeah. And yet we spend so much more treating things like cancer, lung cancer, and smoking-related heart disease, and treating HIV, rather than trying to get to the point where we can prevent and treat the addiction that started these diseases. So it's really crucially important. And I think when I talk to people about, you know, careers, if there's anything that could really make a major difference, it would be working in the field of addiction.
Well, here's what I'm wondering, listening to you talk about this, we can understand or come to understand these addictive pathways and then create drugs to short-circuit them so that the people who are addicts to whatever are able to handle their addiction. What about things like, you know, the 12-step programs and the behavioral stuff that's not taking a drug, but that's actually changing your life through making decisions and things like that. How do those two interact? I would think that, I mean, if you are a person with especially a genetic predisposition toward addiction, could a drug be enough?
No, I think you need both. You need the social support system. You need a very strong social support system. In fact, one of the things that works well is behavioral therapy, you know, cognitive and behavioral therapy. And you actually use imaging to show that the brain changes. The brain changes when you do behavioral therapy. It can be for addiction, it can be for depression. There's some really neat studies that have shown that when you can use an antidepressant drug or you can use cognitive behavioral therapy to treat depression. Both of them make the brain better in turn when you actually look at the chemistry of the brain. So you're absolutely right. That's a key element, an absolutely key element.
So you will be presenting tonight. The program is called Imaging the Brain's Pathways to Addiction. So what will people hear? We're on a radio where you can't see anything. What will people actually be seeing?
Okay, I will show images. I will show pathways, simple diagrams of pathways. I'll show the results of imaging studies. I'll talk a little bit about how we make these images. I'll talk about images of how cocaine moves in the brain, for example, and how this is related to the high from cocaine. I'll talk about some things that we discovered that cigarettes do to the brain that are not due to nicotine. And I'll also talk about a thing called comorbidity, about how addictions go together. For example, smoking. There's a really high rate of smoking in addictions to other substances. And in fact, it's impossible to study addiction in humans, a specific addiction in humans, without also studying smoking, because the rate of smoking in alcoholism and in addiction to other substances like cocaine is very, very high. The rate of smoking in depression is very high. So I'll talk about some of these comorbidity things and what might be explaining this chemically in the brain.
Joanna Fowler is radiochemistry group leader at Brookhaven National Laboratory. She's winner of the National Medal of Science and National Academy of Sciences Awards. And once again, tonight at 6 o'clock, she will lead a student discussion, Imaging the Brain's Pathways to Addiction, sponsored by the Santa Fe Alliance for Science. It's part of the Science Cafe for Young Thinkers program. It's at the O'Keefe Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue. It's free. Everybody is welcome. Refreshments are available. Joanna, I look forward to seeing you tonight at the event, and thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. I look forward to this.